the wonderful way of life that this program offers, the fellowship and the sponsors since March the 5th of 1972. And I remember almost the first thing they said to me. They said, you're going to get a lot of suggestions, and all we're going to tell you about the suggestions that you get is that, you know, when we've got you 4,000 miles or so up in an airplane, and we put you in a parachute, as we're kicking you out of the plane, we're going to strongly suggest you pull your ripcord. And it was, you know, I learned a lot from that. That in order to save my life and find a new way of living, that I had to really follow these suggestions. And I'm just real grateful for a lot of things. Would you join me in the serenity prayer? I'm kind of nervous. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I love that, and I use it lots during a day, because it brings me right back to the beginning, and it's the beginnings that are important. It's the basics that are important for me today. And what that prayer says to me is that I'm the problem. I always have been. It just never was where I grew up, where I was born, any of that junk. It's just, I am the problem, and this is the only thing that I can change is myself. My attitude towards life, my attitude towards people, my attitude towards places, my attitude towards things. And they told me that you're going to start feeling a little bit funny when you mess into other people's affairs. And I found that true. If I try to change others and change things, I get real uncomfortable on the inside, and I don't like that feeling. I just don't like feeling uncomfortable anymore. And they said the wisdom to know the difference is going to come with time and a lot of mistakes. And I said, well, won't I ever someday not make mistakes? And they kind of looked at me strange. And I said, well, you know, the day's going to come when I get there. And they said, where? I said, there, you know, there that you hear people talking about. And my sponsor kind of smiled, and she said, yeah, there with them, huh? And I said, you know, there. And they told me something that I hope, a day at a time, that I don't forget. That they said, you know, Beth, it's like being on a train going into a station, and you're so intent on getting to the station, you're missing all the scenery because you're not looking out the window. And it's the scenery in life that counts. That's life, that's living, and that's what this new way of life is all about. And you don't ever get there. And I said, the day I die, I'll get there. And they said, the day you die, Toots, you'll go to the big meeting in the sky. And when you get there, you walk through those gates, and you're going in as the new person, and you got to start all over again. So forget that one. I mean, they were real kind to me. they always have been. I have a sponsor I still have to call every day, the old battle axe. She even called my house to find out if I'd made it here. And when my kids called yesterday and said, Mother, are you there? And I said, yes, I have arrived. And they said, well, your sponsor called. And she said, it is Saturday morning, and she was supposed to have called on Friday night, and I have not heard a word. And she's still like that, and I'm real grateful for her. She's been sober 40-some years in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's still very, very active, and I love her. I just love her a lot. All I ever heard from you was that it's going to get better if I stayed in these meeting rooms. Nobody's ever told me to keep coming back. They didn't want to give me the edge. you know, stay here, and it'll get better. And I remember the first couple months of my sobriety when I heard that, because I remember hearing the serenity prayer then to, and I knew I'd heard that somewheres, and I didn't know where, and it really isn't important. And I remember I wanted so bad for you to like me. You know, there's nothing worse, I don't think, than the horribly lonely existence when you're into alcoholism. It's and when I say alcoholism, you know, and I heard somebody say, yeah, it's alcoholism, now it wasn't. You're stuck with it till the day you die, so quit figuring out why you got it, where it came from. Just get on with it and find out what to do about it. I remember that you know, I'm talking about alcoholism. I mean the whole ball of wax. I don't care if you shoved it in your nose, stuck it in your ear, put it in your belly button. I don't care. I just figure if it makes you funny dunny up here and it's starting to kill you, something's the matter. But I wanted so bad for you to like me, because there had been days in my life when, you know, you kind of stumble out to the mailbox to get the bills to tear them up, and somebody go along the street and I'd wave, and nobody waved back. Nobody talks to you. Your phone quits ringing. It's even that deathly silence in the house with other people. Even the dog didn't like me. And the cat thought I was a mistake. And I just, no, they wouldn't come near me. And it's just a horrible feeling. And so I wanted you to like me. And I remember when they said, shall we say the Serenity Prayer, I remember making my mouth wiggle and sounds come out so you'd think I knew the Serenity Prayer and I'd be accepted. And that was the first time I got the elbow in the rib cage. And she said to me, look, you don't need to pretend anymore. You don't need to wear a mask anymore. And I promise you something, Beth. If you stay in these meetings and you take the cotton out of your ears and you shove it in your mouth and you listen and you hear, really hear what's being said, the day's going to come when you can say that Serenity Prayer. And you know, I remember the day and I remember the meeting and I remember who was sitting around me when I could say the Serenity Prayer. And boy, I knew something then. I knew you weren't lying to me. And that, yeah, if I stayed here in these meeting rooms and I took the cotton out of here and I put it in here and I listened and I heard, that it would get better. And better started to mean to me that I would be able to live with myself. And that was real important, because I got to do everything with myself. I mean, heck, I brush my teeth with myself. I go to the bathroom with me. Everywhere I go, this goes too. And if I'm uncomfortable with this, I'm going to be uncomfortable with a lot of things. And I got to be real careful about that today. But that Serenity Prayer, that's why it's such a blessing to me. And I'm not going to get into a big, long whinger-do about the drinking. We obviously all know how, but there'll be enough in this so you won't think I just sort of drove by on a Sunday morning and thought, there are cars, I wonder what's going on in there, and came in and here I am. My life actually began around noon on March the 4th of 1972, and I told you that isn't my, we call them anniversaries, you call them birthdays. That really isn't my birthday date. It's March the 5th, because it was the first time that I ever went without having any kind of a mind altering anything pushed into this body. And I don't ever want to forget this day, because I firmly believe today that I was given a gift on that day, a gift of life. Because I was dying. And I came to the realization that I was on that day. I sat there that morning, about, it was around 10:15, I'd finished everything that there was I had to drink in the house. It was the first time that I didn't get that real panicked feeling that there wasn't any more, and just have to sneak out or wait until the family went to church to get in the car and or to walk and get more wine. And I was a wino, and that's very obvious. You know, we remain kind of weird, I think. It's the first time I didn't drink rubbing alcohol, lacing it with orange juice, the first time I didn't drink mouthwash, the first time I didn't go after the cologne. God, I still hate the smell of Chanel No. 5. And it tastes awful going down, I'll clue you. And it's the first time that I just kind of sat there. And I watched my family go to church. And on those faces, I remember seeing everything that I had done and everything that I had become written all over those faces as they left. Nobody said goodbye. Nobody waved. Nobody looked. They just left. And in that horrible silence in that house, I knew something. I knew I was dying. It wasn't because I weighed 62 pounds. It wasn't because my hair was coming out in handfuls. It wasn't because I was vomiting blood and had a lot of bloody noses. I just knew it way down in there. And I knew something else, too, that I wanted to live. I wanted to live so badly, and I was going to go to any lengths that I could to live. And I believe today that little part of me that I call my soul, that little part of it that was still left, that God had not chewed alive, or you know, that alcohol had not chewed alive, was left, and God zoomed in. And I heard. And I've got to believe that. No, I don't think I have another recovery coming. No, I don't believe I have another gift like that's going to be given to me. And that's why I stay in meetings. And that's why I continue to do the basics. Because on that morning, at that particular time, a gift was given to me. And my only belief is that my life each day and how I live it today is going to be my gift back to my God as I understand him. And I did not believe in God then. I had slammed the door on any of that a long time before. But I remember crawling to the phone and yanking it down and dialing my Aunt Jean in Chicago, who at that time had 11 years of uninterrupted sobriety, and I told her I was dying. And I wanted to live. And I needed help. And she asked me over the phone the name of an old-timer who'd never given up hope in me. And his name's Jerry Jackson. And Jerry died in the first part of June in 1978 with almost 40 years of uninterrupted sobriety. Jerry had come into my life in 1962 when I went around Alcoholics Anonymous and played a game. I did not drink until I was 26 years old, and it just snowballed. I didn't like to drink. I didn't want to drink. I knew what it did. And it wasn't that everybody in my family was an alcoholic. There were people that I could have talked to, but I chose not to. I wore a mask. I went through life. I was uncomfortable. I'd have stepped on your face to get what I wanted. But you wouldn't know it because it was all in here. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was some kind of a rubbish compactor, I'm telling you. And when it finally started to come out, it just came out in heaps. I got married, and I didn't like being married. And I married a man who was not an alcoholic, and who lived the 12 steps without being one. You ought to be stuck with that. And I remember where I was. I remember that first drink, and I need to remember that. You know, somebody came up to me. We were at a party, and he said, "Hey, why don't you learn how to smile?" I never smiled. I always went around walking on my face, you know, because you get a lot of attention that way. You know, if you're walking around all doom and gloom, looking at the floor, walking on your face, the whole room gets up and comes over and says, "What's the matter with you?" And it makes you the center of attention. I didn't smile till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, until my sponsor said, "Look, you're reading the big book, you're running around to all these meetings, why don't you smile and give your face something to do so it doesn't feel left out?" And I just never wanted anything to be left out anymore. So I've been smiling ever since. But he said, "Why don't you learn to react? Why don't you have a drink?" And he held that out, and I remember it to today. It was a Manhattan on the rocks with a bunch of goop in it. And I picked that thing up, and it was the worst, awful thing that I had ever tasted in my life. It was horrible. And I made a terrible face, and I finished it to be polite. But then it hit my stomach, and it started making its way through, and it hit this thing up here. And I want to tell you, I got the warmest feeling, and I didn't feel like I was out here looking in anymore. Because I always never kind of felt like you looked, you know? And now I did. I felt like you looked. And I felt like I was a part of you. And God, when I went to the bathroom, that put the frosting on the cake because I looked in the mirror, and looking back at me was Elizabeth Taylor. And that did it. And I was off. And I was running. And it snowballed to the point that 5 years later, my husband said to me, "You have got a drinking problem. You call Alcoholics Anonymous." I didn't think I had a drinking problem. Yeah, I knew I was, you know, having little losses of memory along the line. And I didn't know they were called blackouts. And I thought everybody did, you know? And yeah, I was forging checks because he never gave me enough money. And I was spending money out of the savings account. I mean, he closed those down. And I hear a lot of people crying and weeping around when they don't get back on the checking account and the savings account right away. On my fifth anniversary, folks, he said to me, "Here, you're back on the checking account." And every time I'd open my mouth and suck in air to complain before that, my sponsors would always just look at me and raise their eyebrows, so I never complained. They said complaining does not belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was hiding it. I didn't want anybody to know that I was drinking in the morning and in the afternoon. And I discovered wine. It's rocket juice. Gotta get you where you want to go quick. I was watching this morning when the new Space Who's took off. And I thought, God, I was doing that back in the 60s. They didn't ever call me up. I never broke down. Yeah. I hit it because I just did. That's all. And I'd sneak it into the house, and wine comes in a lot of different sizes, and it makes it sort of easy. You can poke it down the little pint, so that, you know, I could walk in the house and it would be in my pantyhose and I didn't make a lump, and so nobody knew that I had something under there. You can hide it under your mattress. I used to, hide it in the douche bag and in the enema bottle. And that was real convenient. Nobody's going to look in a douche bag, I'll clue you. I pour it in there and hang it up in the bathroom, you know, and you click the hose so nothing leaks out. And then I go into the bathroom, you know, and you just take the handy-dandy little hose and hold up here and then click it and fall out. Men missed a lot. So So, you know, in the enema bottle, different place. The enema bottle did the same thing. On occasion, I would paint them white and tie them to a white rope and hang them out of the window, the second floor window, because I could never read my writing, you know, little maps that I had written and stuff. And that got real frustrating to me. So I'd paint the bottles and I'd hang it out the window because the house was white, and I went out to look and I couldn't see. Then when you're trying to hoover, and you need a little snort, you just pull it up and take it and write down. So I was doing a few little goony things like that. So he got on my case and he said to me, "I'm going to cut you off from your allowance unless you go to AA." And I knew that would be the end. So I went around Alcoholics Anonymous for the first of three times. And if you're new, for God's sake, listen. I walked into these meetings. I drank every day of the week except the one day I went to a meeting because I wanted to look nice. And anybody that's been drinking looks like a halibut. Did you ever see a dead halibut in the store? It does. You kind of get that color. And you got the bags under here. And this is flat. And I walk into meeting, "Hi, how are you?" "Oh, I'm fine." You know? And it, you know, playing the game. Played a game with it. I wasn't honest. It wasn't my fault. It was everybody's fault. Who I was married to, where I lived, all of that stuff. I didn't keep an open mind. I heard your stories. I heard about your jails and your divorces and all that kind of... Hey, that hadn't happened to me yet, and I firmly believe yet is one of the words. It's like an atomic bomb in this program. If it hasn't happened, by God, it will. If you choose to walk out there and do what you do, it's going to happen. And it happens in spades. And I wasn't willing to do anything you asked of me. And 2 years later, the social service workers were called into the house. The kids were going to school not dressed properly. There was a lot of yelling. I was driving drunk in the car with not only my children, but the children in the neighborhood. I was showing up at PTA meetings drunk and telling them exactly what I thought. I embarrassed my whole family, and the kids every so once in a while had a little black and blue mark on, and the neighbors called the social service workers. My husband was a sales engineer, and he had a lot of territory to do, and he couldn't bird dog, and the neighbors couldn't, not when the blinds are pulled and the doors are locked, not when the threats run deep in that house did those children dare to ever say anything was wrong. They spent their lives growing up in total fear. Total fear. But the neighbors were smarter and they called them. And I didn't want to lose my children. All I had ever wanted to be was a good wife and a good mother. So I went back around AA, played the same game, one meeting a week. I don't know anybody who holds a job who goes once a week to their job, for God's sake. I've never seen a kid zoom through school going once a week to school. I don't think it can be done, and by God, I don't think it can be done today. I just don't believe that, and I'm not speaking for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm talking for myself. And 4 years later, a judge looked at me over a who's like this, and he said, 90 days in the workhouse, or Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in on my ninth DWI. I was up on a terrible assault and battery charge. The Summit County Sheriff had picked me up. I'd gone into the soft burn. You know when you drive like this down the road? I have 20/20 vision in this eye. But this got all worn out in those 15 years. And I was driving along, and suddenly the soft burn just kind of came up into the center of the road. You know, sometimes it does hop up there. And I landed in it. And I couldn't get out. And he came. And he said, "Roll down the window." And I did. And he took one look in that car. There was an empty fifth of wine on the floor. There was a half gallon in the back seat. And I was three quarters of the way done with one on the seat. And he said, "I think I better take you home." And I didn't want him to. I mean, my God, what would the neighbors have thought? They'd had a big party. That's what they'd have done. And so he insisted, and I insisted, and he insisted, and I hit him over the head with my wine bottle. I got so mad at him. He had 24 stitches, and I had my picture taken this way, this way, with numbers under, and was cuffed. So I went around AA again, played the same game, one meeting a week for nine months almost. Not honest, not open-minded, not willing. And the next 4 years were hell. It took me right to that dining room table. When Jerry came over, he said to me, "You know, Beth, this isn't going to be easy. Because nothing in life that's worthwhile is easy, but I'll promise you something. If you'll take our hands and you'll trudge this road with us, it will get better." Jerry had started to come over to that home in 1962, not to see me. You know, I could smell him when he was coming. He lived 6 miles away. By God, he'd walk out his front door, and I could smell that sober person coming. We get like that. It's kind of an inner thing we get. You can smell him coming for miles. And I'd run upstairs, or I'd run to my bottle graveyard that was outside where the trees were all marked like Indians did, you know, and do all that kind of stuff. And he didn't want to see me. He gave my family that hope, the same kind of gluing together is what he did that the traditions do for us in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he literally glued them together. There was no Al-Anon. There was no Alateen to speak at that time. But he continued to give them that hope, that same kind of hope that we hang on to when things start getting a little cloudy for us, that same kind of hope that we can rebuild what's been destroyed. And I saw that kind of hope on one day when I was cleaning my house, and I hit a cobweb in the corner, and this little spider came down, boop, on an invisible something, and it was swinging back and forth. I put my mop back to kill it. I can't stand those things. I can stand them. I tried to. And then I saw that movie, Acrophobia, and I don't like them any more than I ever did. But anyway, I couldn't hit him because I thought, he's hanging on to invisible something to climb and rebuild what had been destroyed. And I thought, I'm going to watch him. And I did. I didn't stand there like a goop. I every time I pass, I'd watch because it takes him a little while. But he would put one fuzzy little leg over the other with determination and rebuild what had been destroyed, and it was the most beautiful spider web I've ever seen in my life. It was stronger. When the sunlight would come through the window, it would make colors. It was beautiful, and I understood this hope stuff that you guys talk about with that. And those are things that I have to do. You know, after Jerry had been there, the kamikazes hit, the sponsors. And they came in and they told me everything that I didn't want anybody to know about. And all they were doing was sharing with me. And then they got in a corner. Oh, she's sick. Oh, God, look, she's almost bald. And I was. I lost most of my body hair when I was drinking. You know, these, to answer a lot of people's questions, are not my eyelashes. These are 117 browns. And what you see in my head is my own. But what grew back and what didn't on the rest of me is none of your business. And you don't have to tell everything from up here. Anyway, oh God, is he going to die on us? Nee, 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 nee. So they hit the phone. They called Rosary Hall in Cleveland, which at that time had 5 detox beds for women. And they closed down, because they were painting the walls pink and hanging up polka dotty curtains. They were going to open it to 7 beds for women. And they called Serenity Hall. And Serenity Hall said, "We don't take women at all. What are you, crazy?" And then they called St. Thomas Hospital in Akron. They had 3 detox beds for women. They had a 4.5-week waiting list, and there was no room. And my sponsors looked at each other and decided nobody died on them, and by God, nobody was going to start dying on them. So we went to 2 and 3 meetings a day, 7 days a week for the first 9 months I was sober. And then they bought me street maps of every county in Ohio. They bought me meeting lists from all over the state, and they put them on the counter, and they said, get in the car and go, or stay home and get drunk. Beth, it's just that simple. And it was in those meeting rooms, and it is in these meeting rooms today, that I am continuing to learn how to live. I remember those first months of sobriety. And you know, there was only one time that I can ever remember calling my sponsor up and telling her I didn't want to go, I was too tired. I have never heard silence like that in my life. I don't ever want to hear silence like that again. And then the voice trumpeted over the phone, and she's got a voice. She said, if you think you're tired, what do you think we are? I'll pick you up in 10 minutes. Never again. Never. I practically ran up the street to meet her. As in these meeting rooms, I walked, you know, I felt the handshake. That handshake is so important. Somebody took my very cold hand in their warm one and said, welcome. It was a meeting that I had gone to when I was fiddling around. Nobody said, was it fun out there? Nobody said, ha ha ha, aren't you glad you're back? Nobody said any. I don't know what I'd have done. I really don't. They said, just welcome. That handshake shot through me like it was the first physical contact, you know. And it still does the same thing to me today. I think it's real, real important to shake hands. You never know when you're picking up the hand of somebody that may be something that sticks in their mind and makes them stay here while they're in the beginning of this program. I heard that serenity prayer. I talked to you about that. And I saw a room that I'd never seen before, full of laughter, full of people who, you know, everybody was full of encouragement. And I didn't get things real easy. I really didn't. I had a lot of pictures painted for me. And I remember, excuse me, I remember somebody saying to me, stay away from the first drink. A day at a time, and I didn't know what you were talking about. And in a first drink, I never had one drink in my life. And I remember they said, all right, then walk out these doors, go down the steps, cross the field, and sit on the railroad track out there. And when the train comes along and hits you, get up off the track and tell us, come on back in the meeting and tell us how you feel. I wasn't that jerky. I knew I'd be dead, and I said, I'll be dead. I'll be dead when the engine kills me, and the whole room exploded. Right on, kid, it's the engine that kills you, not the caboose. It's the first drink that pulls something up here over which you have no control. And you know, I have to remember that today because it's the first negative thought that hits up here that can start everything going. And you gave me ways. You gave me things to do. And you know, don't say after the meeting, you know, what if the train's running in reverse? I was taught not to pull things apart, not to analyze, and as far as I'm concerned, it's the engine that has always pulled the choo-choo first. That's important to me. And I never could stay away from the first drink a day at a time. Never. It's right now, and that's how I got to live my life today, is right now. Right now, I know how I'm feeling. Right now, I know what I'm doing. Right now is real, real important to me, and right now, I can do something about anything because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the grace of God. It's just that simple. They told me a story too. They said, you know, if you ever think up here you can go back to being a social drinker. I never knew what a social drink. I never was a social drinker in my life. The closest I ever came to that was when somebody said, I think I'll have another drink, and I said, so shall I, and I got on with it. And so they said, look.
Turn the tape over at this point and continue play on side two.
Beth, it's like you're a cucumber growing in a garden, and it suns on you and it rains on you, and it's okay. But someday somebody comes along and they pick you, and they put you into a deep, dark barrel full. And it is, it's horribly dark in there. There's no day, there's no night, there's no time. And one day they come and take the lid off. Who knows when that is? Days, weeks, months, years. But when they take you out of that stuff, kids, you are no longer a cucumber. You have turned into a pickle. And Beth, there is no way that a pickle can ever become a cucumber again. Now go buy yourself a jar of pickles and keep them in that refrigerator, and always remember it. Once you were a cucumber, Beth, you're now a pickle. You got to learn to live like a pickle. And I keep them. I still have them there. Not the same jar. Life's not that tough. But, you know, and I'll open the refrigerator and I'll look in there and I'll see, what step are you guys on today? You know, if it works, use it, you know. And it helped me. And it helped me to learn how to stay away from the first drink. And as a result, how to live. You told me to get a lot of phone numbers, 25. And they said AAs love to give away their phone numbers. Just ask. And keep them up by the telephone on the wall. I said, I have a phone book. And they said, what good is that going to do you? When this starts going around and this gets all in a knot, how are you going to remember where you put the stupid thing? If they're right up there on the wall, all you need to do is pick up the phone. And the reason for 25, they said, is because if you call the first number and they're on the phone with somebody else, you won't get full of resentment and self-pity and boo-hoo. You'll just go on to the second number. And if they're out and about and living this way of life, you won't get all boo-hoo-y and resentful and full of self-pity. Go on to the next. Somebody in that 25 is going to be home, and somebody's going to listen to you and is going to listen to what you are saying and to what you are not saying, and it's going to save your life and start doing something for other people. Smile. When somebody comes towards you on the street, smile. You know, don't you ever do that? Somebody's coming toward you and they're looking kind of, Smile at them and then watch what happens. They're not going to kick you. They don't hit you with a 2x4. I have seen shoulders go back. I have seen steps lighten. I have seen people start to whistle, and I've seen people who look back over their shoulder and smile back and nod their head. It might be the only gift they've received, and in order to keep this, we've got to give it away. It's just that simple. They told me, in fact, they took me down to a duck pond, my sponsors, and they said, what do you see? And I said, ducks. And they said, what are they doing? And they were just gliding along, and there wasn't a movement on the water. And I said, it looks so peaceful. They're not even making a wave. And they said, all right, put your face under the water, open your eyes and take a look, and then come on back up and tell us what you see. You know, they say faith and fear don't dwell in the same house, but I want to tell you, when those two were here and I'm trying to put my head underwater for a split second, I felt fear for the first time in my sobriety. I thought, what if they're mad at me? And then I got a grip on myself and I did it, and I came up and they said, what'd you see? I said, their little legs are going around like that. And they said, that's right. And you remember something, Beth, if you want serenity and you want peace of mind, your little legs are going to have to go around. It's called active and action in AA. And if you want what those little ducks have on top of the water, your little legs have to go around and you'll have serenity and peace of mind. Sobriety isn't going to come to you and sit on your lap if you're sitting in a corner sucking your thumb. It doesn't work that way. And that's when the action started. And they said, there's a lot of it. You stand at doors, you shake hands, always talk to the new person. When the time comes, you can be secretary, there's chairman, there's sweeping the floors, there's taking down chairs, there's tidying up around, there's answering 12-step calls. There's a lot to do. A lot to do. And just making yourself available. It's a lot to do. And so do that. They told me also the story of the man who was walking through the woods, a drunk, on a very cold November day, with his head down and his arms thrust into his overcoat, and he had his collar up. And they said, and we want you to remember this, because Beth, you know way down deep what got you into. And sometimes if a fleeting thought comes that maybe it wasn't as bad as. Remember, you leave that door open, and this is why. And they told me about the guy walking in the woods. And all of a sudden, he steps on this snake. And he looked down, and the little snake is all covered with snow, and its little fangs are, can hardly talk. And it looks up at him, and it says, would you put me in your overcoat and take me with you? And when I get warm, I'll tell you, and then I go back to my little snake family, or I'm going to die. And he looked down, he said, you got to be out of your mind. Look at the rattles on your fanny. They're like this. I'm not picking you up. You'll kill me. The snake, oh, no, I promise. Gave him all these reasons he wouldn't. And finally the man relented and bent down and picked up the cold old snake and stuck him in his overcoat. And he'd check him out every so once in a while. You're warm enough yet? And the snake would say, no. And so finally the snake said to him, I'm nice and warm and I thank you so much. Now you can put me down and I'll go back to my little snake family and live happily ever after. And so the guy reached in and put him down in the ground, and as he released the snake, he coiled and he struck the man. And as the man was on the ground breathing in death throes from being bitten by a snake, he screamed, you promised me that you wouldn't bite me. You gave me your word of honor. And the snake slithered up till he had his two little beady eyes this far from the man. And he said, you knew what I was when you picked me up. And boy, do I know what that stuff is. Boy, do I know what that stuff is. It worked on my life like an art gum eraser works on a page of paper where you've written in pencil. And if you don't know what an art gum eraser is, go get one. It doesn't immediately erase things. It fades it into the page slowly until it's all gone. It's dynamite. They told me to read the big book, that all the answers are in there. All you need to do is look for them, that there must in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Count them. They're there. They made me count them. I'm not going to tell you how many there are. It took me 2.5 years to come up with the right answer. I'm not giving them to you. Okay? And they said it's all there. Everything you ever want to know is in that big book. That's the greatest love story I have ever read in my life. It is the love story between people who were social outcasts and 12 beautiful steps of recovery given to two men by the grace of God. And it is a book that changes. That's magic. It's different every time I read it. I'm on my 6th big book, and I underline and I write on the margins, and it's wonderful. 2 pages a day out loud, I was told, to get it in here, to here, and down into here. I still read 2 pages a day out loud of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me to read my 24-hour book 4 times a day out loud to get it in here, to here, and down into here. And that, besides Winnie the Pooh, which I had to read because there's a character in there called Eeyore who always complains, and my sponsor said, I don't want you being like Eeyore, complaining and whining about, you know, that and The Little Engine That Could, Those were the only things I was allowed to read for the first 3 years I was sober. On my third anniversary of sobriety, they bought me a box like this, and it was full of every pamphlet of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was full of the Sermon on the Mount, and it had the 12 and 12 in it. But until that time, that's all I could do. I still read 2 pages a day out loud in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still read my 24-hour book 4 times a day out loud. It's real important to me. Very important to me. It's this way of life. And this way of life is where it is. And when I believe so in you, and then I was told to get down on my knees at night, take off my bedroom slippers, shove my bedroom slippers underneath my bed, and say thank you. And I said, to whom and for what? And they said, you've been sober 24 hours, for heaven's sakes. And you'll find out who you're talking to. Quit pushing the river. It runs dandy by itself, you know. Easy does it, but do it. And I did it. And they said, in the morning, when you get out of bed, after you've laid there and listened to the beginning of the new day, and I thought, oh, God, this is like they tell you to take time to smell the flowers. I do that. I lay in that bed every morning. I listen to the beginning of the new day. I hear rain. I hear snow. I hear birds waking up. I hear creaks in the house. I hear life breathing in that house. I used to wake up full of fear, and it was horrible. And guilt and all of those things, not remembering. I can think about what went on yesterday. I can, you know, plan out what I'm going to do today. I make plans, but I don't plan the results. I can do all of this. This is important to me. If it works for you, fine. If it doesn't, forget it. They also told me if I heard breathing of another life in the house and I live by myself, that I better call 911. You never can be too cautious. And then they said, get down on your knees. And while you're grumbling for your bedroom slippers, say to yourself, you're an alcoholic and the problem is you. And ask to make lemonade out of the lemon of life that's bounced your way today, and get up and get on with this thing called living. And I did it because I wanted to be sober more than I wanted to be drunk, and I found out who I was. And oh, I got a relationship with God that I just love. You know, now when I wake up in the morning and I get down on my knees, I remind him who I am so he won't forget. And at night when I thank him for my day, I tell him I hope he had a good one too. You know, you can't play it too close. I'm not a stump jumper. I'm not a pious puss. But this has made all the difference in my sobriety, because he's carried me through some pretty rocky, dark times in my sobriety to you guys. And you know, my God doesn't make junk. I mean, just look around you. There's nothing junky about anybody here. There's nothing junky about the 12 steps or the traditions or the beautiful miracles that go on in this room. It's God gives us so much. And I don't ask why me. I mean, it's stupid because you never get an answer. Why not me? I don't want your problems. You don't want mine. And it's true. We're given nothing more than we can handle a day at a time with his grace. And if we're working hard on these 12 steps of recovery, it's just that simple. I didn't know how to let go and let God. I heard it from all over the place. Let go and let God. Let go and let... I didn't know how until my sponsor said to me, anybody ever fix anything for you when you were little? And I said, yes, my Scotch grandfather. And they said, give us an instance. I remember a raggedy. It was one of the first raggedy Anns on the market, and my mom bought it for me. And she brought it home, and I loved it. I carried it everywhere I went. And one day, the dumb dog got a hold of it and tore off the arms. And it broke my heart. And I took it to my grandpa, and I climbed up on that wonderful, warm Scotch with all the trust of a child. And I said to him, now I didn't give him orders, and I didn't give him a time limit, and I didn't tell him when I wanted it done, how I wanted it done. I just trusted him. And I remember that wonderful Scotch brogue and those kind blue eyes looking at me and said, "Bethy, I cannot fix it." And I have to remember that. I have to let go with all that trust of a child to my God as I understand him when I let go of things. And that, and knowing that God had given me a gift and forgiven me enough about my past life, as we heard last night. And my sponsors told me, if God has forgiven you, who are you not to forgive yourself? Where are you putting yourself? And that helped me through two real tough times. When Annie was three, my oldest daughter, I had a little girl that was a year and a half old, Kimmy. And she had the measles. And you had to watch pretty careful back then when a child had the measles. I was dumping from a gallon jug of wine into different little containers in the sink, and Annie came running out in the kitchen, and she tugged on me, and she said, "Kimmy's acting funny, Mama." And I told Ann to go away. And she was back in a split second, and she said, "Kimmy's laying on the floor, and she's the color of the sky." And I hit Ann, and I told her not to bother me, that I was busy. When I finished pouring wine into those different containers, I went into the living room. The neurosurgeons at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital figured by that time Kimmy had 4 very bad convulsions. Because of the loss of oxygen to the brain, she retrogressed back to a 3-week-old baby and stayed thus. We had her in a private home until she was 8, and by the grace of God. When I could let go of that, and I knew that today, that's the last thing I'd do. I'd run like fury from anywhere to see what was going on. But that alcohol had created that in my life, and I was able to let go and forgive myself. I had a little boy in 1970. He lived 8 days and he died. They fed him whiskey out of an eyedropper every 4 hours. He was born an addict. His mother drank 24 hours around the clock for the 9 months she was carrying him. Always saying it's going to be all right. Always living that lie that alcohol was giving to me. And the doctor called my husband the day after Jeffrey was born and said, "You better come get her. Somebody's put a sign on her door that says murderous, and nobody up here really wants to take care of her." And using the letting go and understanding that was a thing that alcohol had created in my life, and knowing of God's forgiveness, I have been able to forgive myself for those things. You know how you go along and you work. You know the task in front of you is never as great as the power behind you. And as you stay in these meeting rooms and you get friends and they you build up courage, I was able to do my first of many fourth steps. I have done 7 fourth and fifth steps since I've come to this program. And I do a mini inventory every day. And if I get real stressed out or something, I work steps 1 through 4, go down and see my sponsor and do the 5th step with her. It works with me. And I was able to, you know, ask to have the big, icky, pew-stink character defects removed, the anger and the violence in that, and the little shortcomings that poop in and poop out. You know, I still have to wait, do those. And you know, and it's wonderful. I love the 10th step is my favorite because, you know, it gives me the right to be right and the right to be wrong, and you guys too, and that little mini inventory's in there. And I love God. I talk to God a lot, but I wasn't practicing the principles in all my affairs. I'll clue you, and my home group found out about it. I got a home group that knows what I do and say when I'm not even around. And they came down hard on me, and they said, "One of these things is you're supposed to attempt to rebuild what you have destroyed. You go home and you start treating the members of your family like you treat the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. please have a home group. It's real important. You know how it is? Monday morning, you're on the freeway, and you're late, and you know who you get behind? Somebody who's having a spiritual experience with the abutment, and they're going like, you know, 25 miles an hour. It never fails. My knuckles get white. I'm not thinking serenity prayer. I'm thinking about what I want to do with that car. And all of a sudden, up beside me, toot toot, yoo-hoo, a member of the home group. And then you, oh, yeah. Oh, they're wild. They're wild. So I did. I went home and I shook their hands. Hi, I'm Beth. I'm Mama. Because I had a big and four littles when I came to you, and I know who they are. And by the grace of God and you guys and 12 Steps of Recovery, and I know it doesn't always turn around. It's fabulous. They are interested in things. They're interested in this way of life. They love it. And not one of my kids drink. They don't smoke cigarettes. A couple of them don't even swear. And I don't understand that. Maybe it's because we have a swear jar. And it starts at a buck. You know, it's been a big blessing in my life. They understand 12-step calls. And I got to share one 12-step call with you quick. It was the first one I had. I was 11 months sober. And my sponsor called me up. The hand is out, and we are responsible. I said, the what is where, and we're doing what? When anybody, any... I said, all right, I get the message. She said, be ready, I'm picking you up. I didn't want to go. And I told her I couldn't go. And she said, I'll be there in 5 minutes. When the hell are you all right? So we got in the car and we went, and nobody answered the door. And she walked around the house and she came back and she looked at me. She said, go in the garage and see if they got an extension ladder. And I said, a what? She said, she called us. When the... all right, I'll do it. She said, there's an open window up there. Put it up. I said, it's breaking and entering. She called us, and when, oh, God, anything, Mary Frances. So I put it up, and I held it, and she said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm holding it so you can go up. I said, I'm afraid of heights. Faith and fear don't dwell in the same house. So she held it, and she's been shaken since she came in, the Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm climbing this thing, and she's making me take the big book up. And I went through the window, I caught my foot on the windowsill, and I fell right face down on the poor soul who was lying on her back with her holding on to a vodka bottle on the floor. And I was this far from her nose. And I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know what to say. So all I said to her was, did you call Alcoholics Anonymous? She's still sober today. She said, it's totally out of fear. You know, if it works, why not? There have been several other loony things like that. Anyway, my oldest daughter is 36 years old. She and her husband and her three children live about 45 minutes away from me, and I am blessed. I have 5 grandchildren altogether. And the oldest is going to be 12, and the youngest will be 1 next week. 2 are 8. One is 8, one is 9, and one is 2.5. I have learned how to sail paper boats on puddles that rain has left. I have learned what an experience the zoo can be. I have learned how to sit with them and order a chocolate soda and say 1, 2, 3, and we all blow through the straw. And we laugh and people look at us and think we're nuts. I've learned to be a tooth fairy with them. I have learned life from them. God has been. And my granddaughter loves AA, AA, AA. She goes with me. Are you going to AA, AA, AA? And I'm trying to figure out where she goes. She goes up and talks to the speaker always afterward. She doesn't care if they've been sober a year. She doesn't hear that. She always goes up and says thanks for putting more sunshine into Grandma. It's those things that my oldest daughter and I are very good friends. And I remember the day she was married and walked down the aisle in the arm of her grandfather and stopped by the pew, said, thank God for A.A. Mark. Thank God that this is going to be one of the happiest days of my life. My second daughter and mine, Linda, is almost 32. Lenny had a hard go of it in her life. Lenny is pulling in, packing it in together now. Linda has learned a lot. Linda went through a very bad divorce. And Linda is turned her life around 180%. She says it's because of 12 steps and she's not even, but she's gone with me. Says she likes this way of life. My oldest son, Bruce, did not talk to me for the first 3 years I was sober. I'd pass him in the house and I'd say hi, come home from meetings. And you know what you said? Don't squish him like a butterfly, keep your hand open. If he flies away and stays away, Beth, that's what it was meant to be. But if he comes back, you were meant to have him all the time. Just keep doing what you should be doing. That's what's important. So I went to his Little League games, and he'd ignore me. And I'd go to talk to his teacher, and he'd ignore me. And then the day came when he was pitching the final ball in a Little League game. When I was 3 years sober, and his eyes searched the stand and found my ball. And after that was over, he came to me and he said, Mom, you know, it doesn't make any difference if we win or we lose as long as you're here. And I was able to sit down with him to ask his forgiveness for hurting him horribly, physically, when I was drinking. Today, he is a paramedic. He is one of the finest young men I know. And we have a friendship that's just unbelievable. And that little squirt is 27. He's a paramedic and he has an 18 and a half inch neck. And I remember the first time I was home when he was 7 and he came in the house and he said he wanted lunch. I hadn't been sober long. I didn't boil an egg till I had 9 months of sobriety. And he said he wanted lunch and I almost had a fit of hysterics. And I called my sponsor and I said, he wants lunch, what am I gonna do? And this little baseball cap and these eyes came up over the counter. He said, I'll help you make lunch. And she heard him. And she said, you got to crawl before you walk. You came as a child. Learn from a child, Beth. So he took out the peanut butter and the jelly and the bread, and he put two little pieces of bread out like this, and he put the peanut butter over this, and he said, Daddy says, don't do it, or you'll make holes. And it's hard to make holes. And over here he put the grape jelly and then he put it together. He said, this is a sandwich, now you make one. And so with tears streaming down my face, I made my first sober sandwich when my son said, a job well done. And things go along and you get back and you're going to picnics and you learn how to talk to the people in your family, and this wonderful man, Bruce, and I had such, we had a marvelous relationship going. He adored Alcoholics Anonymous. He loved the AA people. And I was 5 years sober and heard the words acute myeloid monocytic leukemia. You were there. You were there every minute of the time. I never heard this man complain. I never heard him put himself before us. And two nights before he died, and we had him at home, and Bruce was 6 feet tall, and he never weighed under 195 pounds in his life. And he weighed 103. And he said to me, "You want to dance?" And I supported him, and we kind of rocked back and forth to an old Sinatra record we loved. And he said, "I want to tell you, Beth, that I thank God and I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for every minute that we have had together. I thank AA for their caring, their love, and the beauty that they have to come into every family and make it so worthwhile, at least to ours." And he told me he loved me, and I held it. And the next day, when he went home to live with God, when his job, "You were there. You put your arms around us. You wiped tears from our eyes. And you turned something that could have been very, very ugly into..." You know, this is a wonderful way of life. No matter what happens, what comes into your life, we got each other. We've got 12 steps. We've got 12 traditions. We've got 4 absolutes. We can be kind. We can be caring. And it just explodes through families. There was not Al-Anon, there was not Alateen back then. And you guys gave my family something that I hope that down the line I will be able to continue to give to a lot of people's families. I want to read you a letter my kids wrote me, and then I'll shut up, get on the plane, and flap on out. They wrote this to me on March the 5th of 1991. "Dear Mom, for 19 years you've taken time, you've cared, you've given love that touches all our hearts. From your laughter and some tears, we've learned how to be responsible for our lives, how to be loyal, how to forgive, and how to go on in spite of, as you say, the times when the clouds seem to block the sun for a while until you pick yourself up and go on. Mother, if we could sit across from God today, we thank him for allowing you to be our mother, for his miracle of you, of AA, for 12 steps to live by, and for your life. Daddy must smile at you from heaven each day and glow at what you are doing. No wonder he called you a precious moment and loved you so. Thanks from all of us, from your grandchildren who know how special you are. Yes, Mom, thank God for you. You are the wind beneath our wings. With so much love to our miracle, our mother." And it's signed Annie, Bruce, Linda, and John. "You have given me this. You have given me, along with the grace of God, my life back. And if I live to be a million, I will never be able to thank you enough. And now may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and the rain fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand in the nows of each day. Thank you. God bless you. Have a wonderful year."